So welcome to our last installment in the series in Luke. Well, we're kind of wrapping it up next week, but next week we're really focusing on Easter, so it's just going to look a little different with some of our branding. But we've been going through this series looking at Luke's gospel, and along the way, Luke has made it clear what the stakes are. And that's something that you have to do when you're developing a story. I mean, imagine that you're writing a drama or a movie or something like that. You need to up the stakes so that your viewers or your readers feel invested in what you're doing. There has to be something to be won or something to be lost. And the easiest way to do that, the easiest way to kind of ratchet up interest really quickly, is to make the stakes world-ending. When you make it that large, then everything becomes really tense and interesting. And so a lot of movies do things like this. They have like alien invasions where the whole world is at stake, or a big disease that's going to take over and destroy all of humanity. It's gotten so popular that even board games have kind of caught on to this. One that I like, it's called Pandemic. I don't know if you've ever heard of it before. Yeah, some of you are familiar with it. Some of you at this point, if you've been around for a little while, are probably wondering if like the board game distributors are paying me to do some of these sermons. Rest assured that if they were, I would never tell you. Pandemic, the basic idea is that there are four diseases that are taking over the world, and so you and your teammates have to both prevent their spread and discover their cures. And so this game's different than most board games. Most board games, you have winners and losers. This one, you all win or you all lose. If you win, all four of you who play this game together save the world from these diseases. If you lose, everybody dies. That's the idea. I even have a fun version of this I've been playing with Kristen and some of her family where there's this legacy version, so you play over like 20 different installments, and what you do in one game impacts the next one. Right now there's like a zombie invasion in Asia, and we're not sure how to stop it, but that's, you know, that's our issue, not yours. One of the things that's really interesting about this board game is, you can kind of see it in the screen, but it's really small up here, the tagline for Pandemic, it says, Pandemic, can you save humanity? Because that's what's at stake, right? And I think the question that I want us to wrestle with this morning is very similar to that, but I'm just going to put a little spin on it, and it's this. Can humanity save itself? Can humanity save itself? I typed this into Google to see what came up, and there's actually a bunch of really interesting articles that come up really fast when you type this into Google. But the third hit was someone who's kind of going over Stephen Hawking's answer to this. We lost Stephen Hawking about a week and a half ago. He was a brilliant astrophysicist who understands things about the world I never will. But he kind of approached this topic, can humanity save itself? And his basic answer to that question is yes, but we've got a dicey 100 years in front of us. See, his issue is this. There's a lot of really big world-ending kinds of things out there that if we don't address, will really spell the end of humanity. Things like nuclear weapons, or drug-resistant antibiotics, or artificial intelligence that decides it's more intelligent than humans. All of these things keep astrophysicists up at night, I guess. And so for Stephen Hawking, his concern is this. He's like, these things will eventually get us. There's no way we can avoid that. But we're really only in trouble for the next 100 years because Stephen Hawking believes that in the next 100 years, humanity is going to figure out how to colonize planets across the universe. And so if we can succeed in that, and then there's some nuclear holocaust on Earth, we're in other places in the galaxy, it's fine. So that's his goal. His goal is to get humanity through the next 100 years so that we're okay when the inevitable occurs. But by finding those technological advancements, by essentially pursuing the stars, humanity really can save itself and its future from all these impending threats. Now, when Luke wrote the gospel, he wasn't really thinking about nuclear bombs or drug-resistant antibiotics. That wasn't on his radar. But he was telling us about the person of Jesus and the things that Jesus was concerned about. And Jesus had a question like this in mind and was trying to communicate to his disciples, to his listeners, that there's a very clear answer to this question. And so, if you have your Bibles, go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 22. That's where we're going to be today. We actually have a good amount of ground to cover because we're going to look at a bunch of events just after the Last Supper. Last week, Heidi took us through the Last Supper. And we heard a lot of what would be Jesus' sort of last words to his disciples right before things were going to get really intense leading to the cross. And so we're actually going to review just the last part of that, the last part of what we call the Last Supper, sort of the last words Jesus says to his disciples and what he was trying to get them ready for because things were going to get pretty crazy. So this is what happens in verse 35. Chapter 22, verse 35. Then Jesus asked them, "When I sent you without purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" Nothing, they answered. Now, this is actually a direct reference to an event we've already covered. And so if you were here when we did this topic back in even in the fall, we covered some of these episodes where Jesus prepped his disciples for some pretty incredible things. One of the more amazing events, one of the things the disciples were never going to forget is when he sent them on their way to all the villages that Jesus himself was going to go. And when the disciples went to these places, they were told not to bring anything with them. They're supposed to depend on the hospitality of the people they met and depend on God for their provisions. And they did this, and God not only provided for them, but they saw incredible spiritual victories that just rocked their world. And Jesus, he's hearkening back to this when he asked them, "When I sent you out with nothing, did you lack?" And they said, "No, we were good." But things are a little bit different now. Verse 36, Jesus said to them, "But now, if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, 'And he was numbered with the transgressors.' And I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment." And then the disciples follow suit, and they say this. The disciples said, "See, Lord, here are two swords." "That's enough," he replied. All right, this is actually a little bit comical when you understand what Jesus means when he says that's enough. So the disciples take him very literally when he says sell your stuff and get two swords. They're like, "Well, it so happens that we already have two here." And so when Jesus is saying that's enough, it's not like two is enough to tango. It's another version of that word. It's like when someone tries to convince me that a pickle is actually good food to eat, I'll finally say, "That's enough, you sound like a fool," right? That's what Jesus is doing right here. That's kind of how this language is. Two isn't enough swords. That's not the point. The disciples are missing what Jesus is telling them right now. What he's telling them right now is that so far in their journey, the disciples have only paid the cost that they themselves were prepared to lay on the table. What I mean by that is this. The disciples, they left a lot behind. They reorganized their life to follow Jesus. But to this point, when Jesus faced oppression or persecution, it really was just directed at Jesus. And so the disciples, along for the ride, didn't like it when that happened, but it wasn't directly threatening them. That was all going to change. From this point on, if they were going to stand beside Jesus, if they were going to follow him, it was going to come at great personal cost. Adversity was right across the way. They weren't going to be able to just skirt by anymore. They had to be prepared for real, meaningful confrontation. And would they stand strong when that day came? And so, it's at the end of the Last Supper, after everything is done, that Jesus does what he has often done. And he takes the disciples to go pray. And he's going to go pray at the Mount of Olives. Sometimes when we refer to this particular scene that we're about to get to, we call it the Garden of Gethsemane. That was a spot in the Mount of Olives. In the other Gospels, it uses that location. But here we've got the Mount of Olives. So here's what's going to happen. Verse 39, Jesus is going to take his disciples. Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." All right, so they're going to engage in prayer because Jesus knows that what's coming is going to be very difficult to deal with. And so the disciples have to get themselves ready now. So he tells them, "Pray now so that when adversity strikes, you will not fall into temptation." Now Jesus himself is going to do this. For the next few verses, Jesus is going to pray very fervently. In Luke's gospel, we see some of those signs, just how passionate this prayer was. There was an angel who was going to come and support Jesus in this time. His sweat was going to be like drops of blood. I mean, for Jesus, this was everything. This prayer was significant as he was preparing for the adversity that he was about to face. But when Jesus is done with this for himself, he goes back to the disciples, and they hadn't been doing the same thing. Verse 45, when he rose from prayer and went back to the disciples, he found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow. "Why are you sleeping?" he asked them. "Get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation." He says the same thing. This preparation is significant. Imploring for God's strength to get through this time of adversity is significant. If you're going to save humanity, you can't sleep through the preparations. Well, the disciples weren't going to get another opportunity to pray before adversity would strike, because in verse 47, things begin to happen. While Jesus was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, "Lord, should we strike with our swords?" And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. In other Gospels, it will tell us that this was Peter, but, you know, they had two swords. Why not use them? And so they did. In an act of self-defense, defending Jesus the only way they knew how, they struck. They used a sword and managed to get near. But this wasn't how Jesus wanted the confrontation to go. This wasn't the kind of battle that he intended to fight. He wasn't going for a brawl. So Jesus says this in verse 51. But Jesus answered, "No more of this," and he touched the man's ear and healed him, undoing the damage that had been done. And the disciples just learned an important lesson, one that was going to actually scare them a lot. It was this. This confrontation that they were in could not be solved by violence. That was off the table. The disciples were not allowed to attack, which threw them for a bit of a loop because now they're kind of out of options. They really don't know what to do here. See, this is the deal. They're facing a really dangerous-looking crowd. You get more of the sense in verse 52. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me, but this is your hour when darkness reigns." So here's this confrontation. Here's what's happening. There's all these really high-powered people who are standing there opposing Jesus, and the disciples, the only thing they know how to do in this situation is to attack, to defend. And yet, if you're going to save humanity, you can't do it with a sword. Jesus is standing there with his disciples. It may have just been the 12, but Jesus had more disciples than that. At one point, he had 72. We don't know, really, how many of them are there that day. Could have been a large crowd on Jesus' side. It could have been smaller. We don't know. But we do know that on the other side of Jesus was a pretty large crowd, made up of a lot of really powerful people. Some who are powerful because they had a very strong military presence. Some who are powerful because of their standing, religiously or in government. And these powerful people were here to arrest Jesus. They couldn't do it during the daylight, as Jesus points out. If they had tried to arrest Jesus while he was at the temple in front of people, many of whom still thought that he was the Messiah who was going to save them from Rome, all this would have gone crazy. There would have been a riot. It would have been bloodshed. And so instead, they're trying to sneak in at night and take Jesus while no one's looking. The problem is there are people there. Jesus' disciples are still right there. So they're coming for Jesus, but there's all these people who seem very ready to defend him. But Jesus' disciples are stuck now because they have this issue. They want to defend Jesus, but they can't do it with swords. They don't really know what else to do. They're kind of stuck here. And so now they're in this really difficult position. If they're going to actually stand behind Jesus, that's going to come at a cost. See, the soldiers are watching. Because when Jesus is arrested, they're going to look at every one of the disciples. And any disciple who makes a move, they're going to have to arrest as well. They're prepared for that. That's why they're coming with all these weapons. But the disciples are starting to pick up on this too. If Jesus gets arrested, and I'm not allowed to fight back, then there's only one other course of action if I'm going to stay with Jesus. I have to get arrested myself. That's the only option available to the disciples. If they're going to follow Jesus into this next step, they would have to get arrested with him. And so this tension is thick. As Jesus and his disciples are on one side, and all these people in the crowd are on the other. And no one's quite sure what's going to happen. Until at last, some of the guards break the tension. Verse 54, "Then seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance." The guards apprehend Jesus. They pull him in. And they begin to look at the crowd of the disciples, wondering what they're going to do. Now in Luke's gospel, unless your name is Peter, we don't hear from you again. Peter, we know, follows at a distance. In Matthew, he actually makes it more explicit. Matthew's gospel tells us that actually, then all the disciples deserted him and fled. When it came to that moment where they had the opportunity to be arrested with Jesus or to flee, when the cost to themselves, when harm was very real, a real possibility, the disciples couldn't pay that cost. They couldn't bear that. Ah, yes, they wanted Jesus to be the Messiah, very much so. But this cost, it was just too high. If you want to save humanity, you have to be prepared to pay the cost. So Jesus is taken to the house of the high priest, and this is where Peter's going to go as well. So Peter is going to follow. He's not going to desert quite yet, but Peter is going to follow Jesus, just at a distance, a safe distance. But one of the things that Luke identifies here is that they're taken to the same place. And so at different points in this next scene, Jesus and Peter would actually be able to see each other. They're in the same house, really. Probably a large house, but they can see each other from time to time. But the attention's going to shift now to Peter just for a second. Jesus will come back to. But Peter, following at a distance, has some decisions to make. This is what happens in verse 55. And when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, this man was with him. But he denied it. Woman, I don't know him, he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, you also are one of them. Man, I am not, Peter replied. So twice now, Peter denies knowing Jesus. If you were here last week, you know that Jesus already predicted this. He actually said that Peter would deny him three times. Three times, Peter would say he doesn't know who Jesus is. Now, back then, Peter defended himself. He said, no, I'm ready to go to prison and to death with you. But today, he finds himself twice denying Jesus. And now he's presented with one third opportunity. Look at verse 59. About an hour later, another asserted, certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean. One more time, Peter's confronted with the opportunity to stand behind Jesus or to deny him. Now, if this was any number of movies in which humanity preserves itself at the end, things might look a little different. This might be the scene where the ring is finally destroyed in the fire of Mount Doom. This might be the scene where the scared villagers and centaurs and hell cells finally overcome their issues and join Harry to face Voldemort. This might be the scene where Luke looks at the Emperor and says, I will not join you, I will not turn to the dark side. And his father ultimately turns on the Emperor and saves his son. Those are stories of humanity stepping up at the last hour. If this was that story, then this is what Peter would have said. He would have said, yes, I am with him, and I will stand by him even in death. But friends, this is not a story of humanity redeeming itself. Instead, Peter replied, man, I don't know what you're talking about. Just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. And Peter, for all his best intentions in the world, fails to stand behind Jesus. Humanity in this hour, when Jesus is most in need, fails. If you're going to save humanity, you cannot exchange the truth for a lie in order to preserve yourself. And yet that's what Peter does. Jesus is going to have to face the next few events by himself. His disciples, his followers, are not going to be there. He's going to have to take these steps on his own. This is kind of how the rest of the story plays out. This is unique to Luke. This is a really fascinating image to look at. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Remember, they're in the same house. So in Luke's version, now they're looking at each other. Their gaze is fixed. And Peter remembered the words the Lord had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. Peter knew exactly what he had just done. And he remembered what Jesus had said to him. And in Luke's gospel, it has a lot to do with this very powerful image right here. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. In the moment of his failure, Jesus locks eyes. He doesn't say anything. But it's almost as if Jesus is saying to Peter, you are not going to be able to follow this next part of the journey with me. This was never your road to travel because humanity can't travel this road. Humanity cannot make it to the cross. It's too far to go. When you look at the Gospel of Luke and you ask yourself the question, can humanity save itself? The answer is a resounding no. Now, I hate to go against a mind like Stephen Hawking's on that. He's a smart guy. And he understands things I never will. But for him, humanity can save itself if it applies its knowledge and its thought and its goodwill for advancement. Then every step along the way, we can find some way to avoid the crises that are in front of us. It's actually really interesting to me. I have a couple friends who are atheists. Some of them I even call evangelical atheists because they're like really excited about being an atheist. It's like they kind of like share that almost with as much fervor as Christians share their faith sometimes. And that's okay, actually. I engage in some really interesting conversations with some of my friends who are like that because they'll send me things like some comics that kind of help me understand a little bit more of their viewpoints. Probably about half of them are really just rants and aren't that interesting. But there's a good chunk of them, these comics, that help me understand a lot about how our world thinks about God and how our world thinks about salvation. I remember this one comic. It was God and his angels around this conference table, and it looked like it had happened maybe just after God had created humanity. And the angels in this comic, they're telling God, God, you made humanity. This is an incredible creation. Well done, God. And God's like, thank you. I appreciate that. That's good. And the angels say, okay, well, you've got this infantile humanity. They don't know very much, so surely you're going to share the secrets of the universe with them. So, I don't know, maybe you can start, God, by just telling them about electricity. And God says, nah, I'll let them figure that one out on their own. And the angels are a little bit stumped at this. It seems like God is withholding some good things from humans. So they keep going on like, okay, well, here's the thing. If you let humans just kind of wander the earth by themselves, they're going to get this weird illusion that the earth is flat, and that's going to give them all sorts of headaches throughout their history. So why don't you at least tell them that the earth is round? God's like, I'll let them figure that out for themselves. And on this goes, where the angels are trying to bring all these things to humanity, all these things that God seems to be withholding, and I realize that that is, in many ways, sort of a perspective that people have on salvation, that for many people, a God who withholds can't be a good God at all. If God was really going to save us, the way he would do it would be to give humanity all the tools it needs to save itself. God could save humanity by giving us all the technological advancements that we could think of. God could save humanity by forcing every war to cease. God could save humanity by elevating us to the status of immortality, maybe even making us gods ourselves. A truly good God would save humanity by giving humanity the means to save itself. That, anyway, is sort of the notion, the sort of the theology of that comic. And I think for us, when we look at the cross and we look at a Jesus who decided to save humanity by subjecting himself to death, it seems entirely backwards from what we would expect. Because we expect God to do something different. We expect God to give us the means to rise past our own issues. But here's the problem, and we know this, right? How long did it take after Einstein developed E equals mc² for us to create the bomb? Humanity could be given all the technological wonders of the world. We could, and we would immediately find some way to misuse it. We're really good at that, as it turns out. And that's because the real problem for humanity isn't a lack of technological ability, isn't even our mortality. The real problem for humanity is the evil that resides within our own hearts. And sometimes we call that sin. And that is what tears us apart from the inside out. And no amount of technological prowess, no amount of gifts can solve the condition of our heart. So the salvation that Jesus had to give was the kind that humanity can never do for itself. He had to take on the evil of all of humanity's heart and die with it. And that is how he was going to change the course of history and begin to move us toward a kingdom in which God really can reign, in which our relationship with God can be restored, and we could find life now and forever with the God who created us. It's different than the narrative of some of my friends, and I get that. And for you today, maybe that's something that you struggled with. It seems like God is withholding from us, but I want to tell you this today. God gave up everything for us. And it's in that that salvation can be had. And humanity, on its own, cannot walk that road. So I think, when Jesus was actually staring at Peter, when they were looking at each other, when they locked eyes, I think that Jesus was also trying to remind Peter of everything that had already happened, because he had already told Peter that, yes, Peter, you will deny me three times, but there's more. In verse 32 of Luke, you see this. He continues to say, "But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail, and when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers." Simon Peter, you are going to deny me. Simon Peter, you cannot walk this road with me. Simon Peter would not be on that cross with Jesus. That wasn't his road. That wasn't something a human can do. But that didn't mean that Simon's story was over. Because later, once the price was paid, Peter would have a role to play. Peter may have not been able to be on that cross that day. We, as humans, could not be on that cross that day. But here's the great news. The thing that keeps us going is that the cross, as amazing as that event was, as much as that allowed humanity to enter into salvation with God now and forever, the cross is not the end of the story.